This is In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. At its core, an inland port is exactly what the name says. It's a non-coastal port of entry for goods, a place where products from overseas can clear customs and then be sorted and distributed, meaning shipped onwards to wherever those goods are going, generally by train and truck, a way of bypassing overcrowded and backlogged ports on the coast. It's also a point of export, a place where manufactured, farmed, or perhaps mined or extracted products can be sorted, processed, and then distributed to overseas markets. Last week on the show, we heard the story of the largest inland port in the country, the Center Point Intermodal Facility in Elwood, Illinois. After it was built, residents there complained about safety, noise, and air pollution, and the city of Elwood sued the port's developer over the way the project was financed. Elwood, as the journalist Alexander Salmon told me, reaped far fewer benefits from its port and more drawbacks than it had anticipated.
I think that they probably thought that even with these tax abatements and even with this kind of generous sweetener package that they offered, that, you know, the amount of wealth it would bring to town would trickle down in ways that weren't immediately apparent, and that everyone would reap in the benefit of this and the increase in property values, you know, what have you. There were other ways that they might make this money up. And, you know, after 15 years of this, we see that that finally is not the case.
You can find my full conversation with the New Republic's Alexander Salmon about the Elwood Inland Port at kcpw.org. This week, we're turning our attention to the planned Utah Inland Port. One state lawmaker called it probably the largest economic development opportunity in the history of the state, and its proponents say it will be a driver of growth and jobs. It will be built on a portion of 16,000 acres, that's 25 square miles, of undeveloped land on Salt Lake City's west side, a couple of miles east of the Great Salt Lake. This is what the epicenter of that project sounds like right now. That's 7200 West, not far off of I-80, an area that seems to be the intersection of salt marshes and sage country. There's a gate to a state trust land site that makes up a portion of the inland port directly north of the highway. As you can hear from the jet overhead, the airport's not too far away, and to the west of here is the site of the new state prison. All of this would be smack dab in the center of the inland port development area. If you're like me, you might not have heard of the inland port until a year ago or so, but the project has been on the minds of planners in northern Utah cities for decades. Last year, the state legislature passed a law creating the inland port, a law they amended in a July special session to try to address concerns from stakeholders like Salt Lake City. That law set the wheels slowly turning on a big, contentious, expensive project. Today on In the Hive, two perspectives on the inland port. We'll hear from the port's board chair, Derek Miller, a champion of the project, and from a community organizer who has concerns, lots of concerns, Dita Seed with the Coalition for Port Reform. In my interview with Port Authority board chair Derek Miller, I started by asking if that language about the port being the largest economic development opportunity in state history was real, or if it was just hyperbole.
Yeah, I actually do not think that it's hyperbole, but we need to remember that what we're talking about here is a project for the next 50 years. Often I see and hear about misperceptions that we're going to go out to the Northwest Quadrant and build a 10,000-acre port. That is not what we're going to do. We're talking about building a port of a few hundred acres, you know, just a small percentage of the Northwest Quadrant, but a few hundred acres that will drive the development of a few thousand acres. And that few thousand acres will take a number of years, you know, maybe even 10 years or longer to develop. So it is in its entirety that this has the chance of being the state's largest economic development project. And then I would add to it something very important, that we're also not just talking about the Northwest Quadrant. We're talking about the entire state of Utah, even the entire Intermountain West, because what the inland port does is act as a magnet for commerce. This becomes a channel for commerce, for loading, unloading, as well as clearing customs. All the things that happen at a seaport now happening inland, which you're bringing as a commerce from the Western United States to Utah. That's the opportunity in a nutshell. That's why it's so big.
Drawing commerce to the region is just one part of the vision for the inland port. I asked Derek Miller if and to what extent the project was about exporting Utah products.
So yes, to answer your question, it is about exporting. And let's look at what we export now. Our top exports are, first and foremost, what we call primary metals, the things that come out of the ground. Most people think about the Kennecott copper mine, but it's not just copper.
Right.
There's gold, there's silver. Utah is a center for refinery of precious metals. And then you look at what else we export, information technology, both hardware and software. We hear all the time about the tech boom going on in Utah. You know why there's a tech boom? Because they can sell those products that are made here in Utah all around the world. Just quickly to round out the other large export categories, after primary metals, after information technology, you have chemicals, you have transportation equipment, and you have agriculture.
Right.
Really important to remember agriculture because this impacts the rural parts of our state, and we need to be considering how we help drive those economies as well.
When I asked Dita Seed with the Coalition for Port Reform about the export potential for the inland port, she had a different view.
The Port Authority is in the process of getting bids for someone to develop a business plan that hopefully will look at that. But in our conversations with Union Pacific officials, it's not clear that Utah has enough to put in those train cars going out. And so that's where the fossil fuel piece comes in, because like, well, what do we have to export? Well, we have fossil fuels, but not much else.
Since almost the first day the bill was passed creating the Utah Inland Port, environmental organizations have suggested that it might be a way for the state to increase exports of fossil fuels like coal, something that they are opposed to. Earlier in our conversation, I asked Dita Seed if that's what she thought the port was about.
Well, some legislators would like it to be. It's not clear how that makes economic sense yet for anyone. For example, coal in Utah is mined in central Utah. And there's already a Union Pacific line in central Utah that goes west and south to Los Angeles and then to Mexico. So we've been trying to piece together what that would look like and why anyone would want to do that. I think the only way that's going to happen is with subsidies, which is actually very upsetting to us because we certainly don't want to be subsidizing the fossil fuel industry. Energy industry lobbyists have suggested that the port will be used to facilitate the export of waxy crude from the Uinta Basin.
This is petroleum, oil. Yeah.
Through transloading facilities. We've heard discussions about an oil tank farm that would holds waxy crude for the refineries. So there are all kinds of schemes out there. There's a lot of people are running around acting, well, they're speculators, you know. They're looking to make a buck and they're peddling these ideas. We suspect that legislative leaders sold this to rural legislators as a way for them to extract and export fossil fuels from Utah's public lands.
You mentioned waxy crude coming from public lands. What are your sort of larger concerns with petroleum transfer at the inland port? Is it pollution as well?
Absolutely. Pollution and the danger of explosions from those products, the emissions into the air, and then also the fact that that's a giant carbon bomb. And, you know, does Salt Lake City want to be in a position where we're expediting the extraction of fossil fuels, which contribute to climate change, through a port that we're subsidizing with our tax dollars?
A feasibility analysis at the port's website includes a line that reads, "The Utah Global Trade Port should be integral in growing the state's natural resource and extraction industries." But Port Authority Board Chair Derek Miller says that when it comes to coal being moved through Salt Lake City, his board doesn't have much control.
Here's the reality. The Inland Port Authority has no control over that. Who does have control over it is Salt Lake City, because they retain the zoning control. And they've already passed zoning amendments that say, first of all, you can't store coal anywhere in the Northwest Quadrant. And secondly, if all it is going through, it has to be covered. So that question's been answered, and it was answered by Salt Lake City, not by the Port Authority.
Yeah, and the problem with that is that you can't really cover your coal containers. I mean, there's right now they spray a kind of sticky substance on the coal to prevent the coal dust from getting out. And BNSF Railway in Seattle has been sued because of coal escaping from their train cars going through areas of Seattle. And so Salt Lake City, having done that, saying cap your coal cars, I don't know if that's even a possibility that can be done.
Right, but what they've said is if you're going to ship coal through here, it has to be taken care of. So they're the ones that set the rules, and there'd be rules that, of course, we would live by.
Pollution from coal dust dislodged from train cars or in the form of exhaust from trucks is at the forefront of Dita Seed's mind as she thinks about the future of the Wasatch Front, because, she says, our air quality issues aren't going away.
We're very concerned about the air quality problems that will likely ensue with this huge complex of warehouses that are dependent on diesel trucks and diesel equipment for moving freight.
And that's the most obvious reason for the pollution, is this increase in truck traffic. Do we have a way of quantifying what that looks like? I mean, how many diesel trucks, you know, what that increase looks like?
We don't, because we haven't seen any real plans for what this thing is going to look like. But we know from other inland ports around the country that we can expect, if this is fully built out, thousands, perhaps as many tens of thousands of truck trips per day over what we have now.
Maybe you can elaborate a little bit, Dita, on why air pollution is such a central concern for the Coalition for Port Reform, coming from those increase in emissions, where we are specifically.
Right. Well, right now we are not complying with federal air quality standards. We are failing to meet the standard for emission of particulate pollution, also known as soot, which is a very harmful form of pollution that causes all sorts of adverse health consequences. So we're already suffering from bad air, and we don't have a solution yet in place to fix the problem we have now. And it to us, it feels irresponsible to be considering something that could be creating, you know, literally tens of thousands of tons of more pollution with this truck traffic when we haven't solved the existing problem. But also, we don't like the idea of our tax dollars going to a development that's going to pollute our air. And that, as far as we can tell, there's no way to do this without having an increase in emissions.
I also pose the question of truck pollution to Derek Miller from the Inland Port Board. Won't this port mean a sizable increase in truck traffic and therefore in air pollution from emissions?
Not necessarily. And I think that's the important part, is that we need to study it to understand the facts. So most recently, as we've looked at this project, we first commissioned a study from the Kem Gardner Policy Institute at the University of Utah to look at other inland ports. What does it take to have a successful inland port? How can you mitigate some of those environmental concerns? What's been done elsewhere? And what we found from that study was that Utah was very well positioned for an inland port for a number of reasons. We've talked about some of them as far as our export economy goes. And now we are in the midst of two very, very important efforts. The first is a creation of a business plan. That business plan will look at not just the economic impacts, but also the environmental impacts. So I tell people all the time, let's get the experts, let's study it, let's find out what's going on. The second very important effort that we're engaged in is a public outreach effort. So to the extent that there are groups that are interested in this, I think it is awesome. We need to have more of them. We need to have the public more engaged. It will only make this a better project in the long run. Now, very quickly to your specific question as to the truck traffic and why I said not necessarily so. Here's what we have to remember. Two things. the economy is growing now, and I'm talking now about the national economy and the international economy. We have trucks on the road. We have trains on the rails right now. They drive on I-15. They drive on the I-80. The trains are on the rails that go from east to west. If you want to get a train from the east to the west, you have to go through Salt Lake City. It is the way that you go. So that is happening now. And it is only going to continue to increase as the economy around the world and our country increases. That's not in question. Here's what is in question. What can we do? What can we build in Utah to both take advantage of those trucks that, by the way, don't stop here now? They just drive through. So that all they're doing is leaving their pollution. They give no value to this state. What could we do to build something where we actually could get value and at the same time control the development and control the growth in a way where we can actually mitigate some of those concerns? Because right now we have zero control over it, zero. But if we can get those trucks to stop here, and if we can get those trains to stop here, then we have some control. Then we can start saying things like, you know what, instead of driving through the Salt Lake Valley, why don't we build a transloading station before you get to the valley where we could move goods from trucks to trains to reduce emissions? Then we have some control. What if we were to say, you know what, if you're going to come here and you're going to stop here at Utah's Inland Port, then you have to be using clean fuel. You have to be using electric trucks. All those kinds of things that now we will have a say in with an inland port.
A pending environmental assessment will probably have more to say on just how much truck traffic the port will attract, but there are still more environmental concerns surrounding the port's development, in particular the impact it will have on the already distressed Great Salt Lake ecosystem.
Just for context, Great Salt Lake ecosystem hosts up to 10 million migratory birds a year from over 300 species. And there are wetlands, playas, and uplands that, you know, make up that ecosystem. And this project will have a direct and very detrimental effect on those wildlife habitat areas. And we're deeply concerned about this because with climate change, saline lakes, like Great Salt Lake, are drying up all over the West, and Great Salt Lake increasingly is the last place for these birds to go. And huge numbers, almost entire populations of some species use the lake. What's scary about that is that if we do things wrong here, we could wipe out an entire population of birds. So the species conservation issues are huge. They frequently are secondary in the conversation to the concerns about what will happen to human health. But where go the birds, so go the humans. Birds have smaller lungs. They're impacted by air pollution. There are concerns about what kind of mosquito abatement is going to have to happen in the area to accommodate humans working there. And that's going to, you know, kill off the birds' food. It's just a cascading set of problems that could profoundly impact the ability of these already jeopardized birds to survive.
Again, the Port Authority Board is waiting for environmental impact studies, but Derek Miller said they weren't ignoring the question of impacts on the ecosystem and that the board wanted community feedback on this and other topics.
Of course, I don't know what the impacts would be because we haven't done the study yet, but I will say that going back to those two important efforts in which we're involved, one, the environmental study, and number two, the public input, those are going to be critical to understanding the sensitive areas out there. But I will say a lot has already been done on this effort. In fact, two important things to note. The first one is because the land in the Northwest Quadrant is privately owned and has already been entitled by Salt Lake City for development, they went through a process already. This happened a year or two ago where they looked at what the sensitive areas were and through that process with the city identified some land that should not be developed and another parts of land that would be a buffer zone to help with those ecologically sensitive areas as well as the bird migration. So that was something that was done before the Inland Port was even created. Secondly, when the Inland Port was created by the state legislature, they actually took more land and set it aside than even Salt Lake City had done to make sure that there was adequate buffers put in place.
One other point of divergence between port proponents and detractors has to do with jobs. growth and jobs, Dita. Those are
right.
Desirable things for the state.
Yes, except that the jobs, as we're learning, that come with warehouses are not good jobs. They're, as we're seeing in the situation in Elwood, Illinois, that has the largest inland port in the nation, they're frequently temporary jobs without benefits, low paid, very unstable employment, not something that we would want to subsidize in any way. Those are terrible jobs. You know, Amazon's warehouse opened up not too long ago with jobs that pay $12.50 an hour. These are not great jobs. The people who are going to do well off of this are a few already wealthy developers. Yes, those people will make a lot of money. The rest of us will pay for them to make money and will suffer the consequences of this development in terms of reduced quality of life, you know, inability to breathe the air, harm to our children. The more research we do, the more we find that this is just a recipe for disaster for most of us.
Derek Miller, though, says that warehousing is only part of the equation. He imagines the inland port drawing a different kind of business.
High-end clean tech manufacturing jobs. We need to create jobs in this state, in this country, where people are building things. And that's exactly the kind of industry, that's exactly the kind of jobs that we're talking about. Let me give you an example.
Please.
One of the site visits that we did was to an inland port in South Carolina. It helps to feed those East Coast seaports. And it was co-located next to a BMW manufacturing plant. This is not the kind of auto manufacturing plant that you think of when you look at pictures from the 60s or the 70s. It looked like a hospital. I mean, it was like clean tech, clean room, people walking around in white suits and robots all over the place. I mean, this is the manufacturing facility of the future today. Those are the kinds of manufacturing jobs that are attracted by inland ports. Why? Because they see the value of being co-located to or next to something that can get their goods to market quicker. And in the modern economy, that is what it's all about, time to market. You know, when you order something online, when any of your listeners order something online, they're measuring now in hours, not days, and certainly not weeks for when it arrives. So the question that we have to be able to answer is, how is Utah going to play in that economy? And the inland port gives us a great advantage.
Can you comment, though, on the idea of spending taxpayer money on attracting what could be low-paying jobs in the warehousing industry?
Again, that's exactly my point. If we do nothing, it will fill. And when I say nothing, I mean if we do not do an inland port, it will fill up with warehouses. That's the default. That's what you've got going on there now. That's what will continue. Can we change that trajectory? Can we do something to put in a few hundred acres of infrastructure that bends that curve so now we're attracting manufacturing, high-end, good-paying jobs rather than just warehousing jobs?
You heard Miller mention the BMW factory beside an inland port facility in South Carolina and the robots building cars there. The topic of automation was one that we addressed on last week's show, though that conversation focused mainly on the impacts of automation on the warehousing industry in particular. I asked Miller if he was concerned about the potential of automation to eliminate jobs at the port before it was even built.
I think in the port facility itself, having automation will be great because, you know, you can do electrification and automation that will significantly drive down the environmental impact. But what you described with regards to warehouses and distribution centers is what I believe exactly what will happen if we do nothing. If we do nothing in this area, it is not a choice, by the way, between building something there or building nothing there. I mean, this is privately owned land that's been entitled and zoned by Salt Lake City.
But it's missing some infrastructure. I mean,
that's that's my point. That is exactly my point, is that if you do nothing there, then what will happen is it will fill up with warehouses. And it will fill up with warehouses and distribution centers that will be not high-paying jobs. That's what will happen in the Northwest Quadrant if we do not have an inland port, because you will not have any manufacturing that is going to locate there without putting the inland port facility.
As far as the area self-developing and filling up with warehouses if the inland port isn't built goes, in response to a question about the financing of the port, Dita Seed with the Coalition for Port Reform said that the limited infrastructure out there meant that that wasn't likely to happen on its own. How will the infrastructure itself, the development of the port, be financed?
By us.
In what way?
Well, our tax dollars are going into the infrastructure that's being built for the prison, and that has been touted as the first piece. But, you know, basically on the north side of I-80, it's a greenfield development. Other than the prison, there isn't the infrastructure in place to develop the port. And so, yeah, one of our concerns is that, to add insult to injury, you know, not only will our air quality be harmed and we'll suffer other consequences, but we're supposed to pay for the roads, the sewers, water, to make this thing happen. And that's deeply disturbing to me.
Given the concerns she and others in her coalition have been expressing about the inland port, I asked Dita Seed if the coalition wants to kill the project altogether.
We're having that conversation right now. There are a number of member groups that do want to kill it, but think it's a terrible idea. And my organization, the Center for Biological Diversity, is one of those. You know, what we hear is, oh, well, it's already happening. Well, our answer to that is, yeah, but you need our tax dollars to build this thing, so it's not already happening because we have not handed over the money yet, although certainly the state is trying to make that happen. But the downsides of this are enormous. We should not be subsidizing something like this. They haven't done their due diligence. Some people have described it as magical without anything to substantiate that. So we're going to fight this all the way. And, you know, the bottom line is we've learned there's no such thing as a clean port, and we don't want this in our community.
So does that mean that there's a potential for lawsuits on the horizon?
Yes, absolutely. Litigation is something that we're looking at. Obviously, that is not what you want to do, you know, right from the start. But if it comes to it, we will defend our quality of life, our air quality, our health, and push back on this in the courts.
For his part, Derek Miller says he welcomes input from community members and that that input will help create better outcomes for the port.
We're so glad to see these groups who are interested, who are invested, who are giving input that help us to have a better product than we would without it. Those are the next steps, getting that public input, helping us to guide what do they want there. I mean, maybe the public would come back and say, no, we're just fine with warehouses. Fill it up with warehouses. We don't care. I doubt that will be the case. I think that the public will give us some great input to talk about how we can mitigate the environmental concerns and at the same time continue to plan for the economic prosperity of our state. You know, and I'm sure all your listeners know because they hear it all the time, we have one of the most economically prosperous states in the nation. That did not happen by accident. It didn't happen by happenstance. It came because generations before us were planning well, putting in infrastructure, and now we have to think, what are we going to do for the generations to come? The inland port isn't so much about jobs for me or jobs for you or maybe even jobs for your listeners. We're talking about jobs for the future generations. That's the significance of the project that we're planning for.
Time frame in terms of planning stages, and then we start to think about how long it'll take?
I hesitate to even guess because I want to see that business plan, and I also want to see that public input that'll help guide it.
On the topic of public input, the Utah Inland Port Authority Board is holding two open houses in the near future. One will take place at the State Fairgrounds at 155 North 10th West in Salt Lake City this coming Tuesday, February 19th, from 6 to 8 p.m. The next will take place Thursday, February 28th, at Franklin Elementary School at 1115 West 300 South, also from 6 to 8 p.m. We'll provide further details at the In the Hive show page at kcpw.org. There's a good deal we didn't talk about relative to the inland port on this show. For example, the Salt Lake Tribune this week reported on the lingering concerns of Salt Lake City School District, which will lose tax revenue over the next 25 years to the tune of $500 million or more because the state gave control of that tax revenue to the Port Authority Board, wresting control from Salt Lake City. So check out that coverage and let us know what else we're missing. Weigh in on KCPW's Facebook page or email us at comments@kcpw.org with the subject line Inland Port. In the Hive is a production of KCPW Public Radio in Salt Lake City, a listener-supported, independent news and information resource. The show's theme music is by Andrew Shaw. Find podcasts of this and all our local programs at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening.